Nearly 3 out of every 4 Wisconsin voters in April approved amending the state constitution to include specific rights for crime victims. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent today. Hard to imagine 75% of Wisconsin voters agreeing on anything in our current political climate, but it's easy to understand when you consider Wisconsin's history of attempting to institutionalize empathy. Call it Wisconsin Nice. We were the first state to create a crime victims' bill of rights 40 years ago. We added victims' rights to our state constitution more than 25 years ago. And this spring, the voter support for Marcy's Law was resounding. And we start your state capitol report this hour with finding out how well we're doing on behalf of crime victims. And if you have any insights, please share. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Rachel Sattler. She's an attorney with the Crime Victims Rights Project and coordinator of the Volunteer Lawyer Project Madison Office at Legal Action of Wisconsin and the co-founder of the Dane County Multi-Agency Center. Rachel, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with a look at a compare and contrast. How does Marcy's Law compare to the existing victims' rights statutes already on the books in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, I think that historical context that you gave in the intro is really important. Wisconsin has long had a robust set of statutory rights that are designed to protect victims against systemic wrongdoings and disregard by state actors, more specifically law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, and judges. So we had a really robust set of laws. Marcy's Law, in many ways, amplifies what was already existing, arguably, in those statutes. While there are some differences in the language and perhaps some clarity in the scope of the rights, it's in my assessment and in my colleagues' assessment, fairly clear that many of these rights already existed.
Those rights that already existed, Rachel, were they being applied in court cases? Were they actually being used?
Yeah, so obviously, laws only develop as people pay attention to them. And while the rights are designed to protect victims as cases move through the system, in reality, the people whom the laws are supposed to protect victims from, those law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, and judges, are also the same individuals in the system who are enforcing those rights. So there has been a tendency, I think, to fall back on the use of discretion and sort of the minimal operational standards that those statutes require to make sure that victims have a place at certain parts in the system that are sort of widely accepted. But there hasn't really been, up until recent years, much challenge to what those laws mean, because there really hasn't been victims who are represented by attorneys and victims who have a deep understanding of the broad scope of their rights under those statutes.
So since Marcy's Law became an amendment to the state constitution, how have you learned how it's applied in the courtroom? How have you received any guidance, and from where?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of our main sources of guidance is going to court and working with those laws. And so we're informed by actually practicing in court. And our team of lawyers works throughout the state. So we can sort of get an assessment of what is happening throughout the state, but it is very limited because there really are only a handful of lawyers who specialize in this area of law. As we've observed since Marcy's Law's passage, there is an increased awareness, certainly, to victims' rights in general, both those in the new laws in the Constitution and those that are reflected in the statutes. But our observations thus far, it's a little too soon to determine whether the attention that is being paid to these laws will result in lasting systemic change, or dramatic, modifications to the way the criminal justice system, permits victims to participate in the process. So there is an awareness and an attention that's being paid to these laws that I would say is new by everyone that works in the system. But it's hard to predict right now whether that will die down or continue.
So the way it sounds like there may be a lot of discretion still when it comes to how Marcy's law would be applied in the courtroom.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Every county, every court within a county has discretion to make decisions about how a victim participates in the process, and DA's offices and court systems and law enforcement agents to create their own sort of policies and procedures, which means that victims are treated very differently depending on where you go, whether that's the municipality or a specific courtroom within the same county. Victims are treated differently depending on where their case is.
Protecting the victims seemed to be the overwhelming intent of the voters this past spring. Our guest is attorney Rachel Sattler. She works with the Crime Victims' Rights Project. Prior to this, she served as a prosecutor in Milwaukee and Madison for a decade, specializing in cases of sexual assault, domestic and dating violence. If you are an attorney or involved in the criminal justice system and have some insight into how we protect victims in our court cases and how we protect the rule of law, 1-800-642-1234 is a number to our studio. Rachel, so we can better understand how this is working in practice now, can you give us an example of how you've worked to make victims heard in a criminal case and where Marcy's Law might fit into that?
Yeah, well, I think starting a few years ago, right around the time of the Me Too movement, I started observing an increased interest in victims to participate and actively seek to enforce their rights in court. And that is a distinctly different experience than previously, where victims may have the desire have had the desire to participate and done so to the extent that they believed they could. There has been an increased desire to push on what that means and to be heard in new ways on issues. So one example that we frequently work on is in the area of a victim's right to privacy. For example, in sexual assault cases, it's really common for either the prosecutor, the state, or the defense to want to see the privileged mental health records or medical records of a victim. And while our courts have developed a system and there are statutes in place designed to protect the privacy of victims, victims previously didn't have a role and weren't able to participate in those motions. And that's something that we've been working on and on behalf of our clients.
It's Rachel Sattler, our guest this morning for your state capitol report, an attorney with the Crime Victims' Rights Project and coordinator of the Volunteer Lawyer Project, Madison Office at Legal Action of Wisconsin. 1-800-642-1234. Chances are you voted for Marcy's Law. Now that it's in the courts, what do you think? We'll take your call when we continue with Rachel Sattler. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. So, how are Wisconsin's courts juggling the rights of the accused and the rights of crime victims following the most recent amendment to our state constitution, known as Marcy's Law? And how is it different during this pandemic? It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and attorneys, officers of the court, judges, jury members, those that have stood accused as well as the injured, we want to hear from you this morning about your courtroom experience. 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney Rachel Sattler is with the Crime Victims' Rights Project and our guest this morning. She's also a former prosecutor serving in the Milwaukee and Madison areas, specializing in sensitive crimes. And Rachel, earlier this month, a Dane County judge said that Marcy's Law should be thrown out. It appears as though the Attorney General, State Attorney General and Department of Justice is now reviewing this. How does, so where does this amendment now stand in the books? Is it still part of the Constitution? And what do you expect next?
Well, yeah, it is still right now part of the Constitution. And I anticipate that there will be continued challenges, not just to that decision, but perhaps other areas of Marcy's Law. That has been the subject of litigation in other states that have enacted Marcy's Law as well. So we don't foresee the debate surrounding it ending anytime soon. When it comes to the practical realities of what that means for victims and the system as we navigate these laws, it's important to remember that while these laws are enforceable right now, the rights are also reflected in the statutes. So one thing that we've been careful to do is to ensure that, you know, the advocacy that we're doing and the work we're doing on behalf of our clients is not based solely on those constitutional laws that were adopted through Marcy's Law, but rather based on long established statutes.
So then how does Marcy's Law affect the rights of the accused? It's intended to protect the victims, and the voters in Wisconsin overwhelmingly supported that. But are there concerns that the accused could be considered convicted before the actual court case with the way Marcy's Law could be applied?
That's a really good question and a complicated one. Obviously, that is a huge component of the debate that exists. But I think it's important, again, to keep in mind that there was already language in our Constitution and statutes that articulated sort of an equalization of victims' rights and defendants' rights. That's not to say that a defendant's rights aren't extraordinarily significant and that due process isn't required in these cases. But I think it is possible to give victims a role in these proceedings and give them a voice when their rights are implicated in the criminal justice process without violating the rights, the very important legitimate rights of a defendant throughout the process as well. I don't think one necessarily comes at the cost of another.
Have you been able to witness yet how Marcy's Law is being applied by defense attorneys and how they are taking this constitutional amendment into consideration?
It's really hard to draw generalizations because this is still really fresh and people are still sorting it out. I think as well, there are complexities as a result of COVID that make it hard to sort of analyze the broader picture of what is happening with Marcy's Law. So we have anecdotal, you know, observations based on the limited court appearances that we've been doing on behalf of our clients, but that is by no means worthy of drawing conclusions drawing larger assessments about what's happening on the ground. COVID is really creating challenges for everyone involved, courts, defendants, DAs, and victims. So,
well, Rachel, you've laid out clearly here that we're seeing some inconsistencies from courtroom to courtroom, county to county.
Yeah.
How would you begin to resolve some of these inconsistencies so that you don't have to find out when you get into the courtroom, but know before you go?
Yeah, I think that, there are all sorts of organizations in the Department of Justice who provide guidance and trainings for people who work within the system on best practices related to victims' rights. But I really think that the way we make sure that victims are heard in court and treated fairly is to give them that opportunity, whether that's through litigation and sort of the pursuit of challenging what these laws mean, to develop the law, or simply inviting victims into the parts of the process that they have a right to be heard at, but have not yet been regularly participating in. I think that those are two ways that we can really get a broader approach to victims' rights. If, as law develops, then courts have legal binding precedent, and everybody that works in the system has precedent that they can look to and follow to determine what their policies and procedures should be.
Rachel Sattler is an attorney with the Crime Victims' Rights Project, also coordinator of the Volunteer Lawyer Project Madison Office at Legal Action of Wisconsin, and the co-founder of the Dane County Multi-Agency Center. Taking a look at Marcy's Law in our state constitution and what it means in our courtrooms, what it means for victims as well as the accused, what can you share about your experience in a Wisconsin courtroom? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to the studio. And Rachel, you gave us one example of limiting access to victim mental health records and medical records. Are there other tangible ways that you've seen Marcy's Law at work in the courtroom this year?
Yeah, one very interesting component is, victims have had a right to a speedy disposition in the statutes for a long time. That's similar to a defendant's right to a speedy trial. What that means and how that's defined, again, is sort of dependent on where you are, but that is an area where, the accused and the victim's interests oftentimes align, and in this age of COVID has been a particular challenge for not just the accused but victims as well. How do you get a speedy disposition? Victims waiting for years and years for cases to resolve adds to their trauma, and that's a problem, and one a concern that is shared by victims and accused alike.
So, since this pandemic, the court system has had to struggle with how to find a speedy trial, among other things, how to adjourn a jury. What are some of the ways that you've seen this pandemic impact the criminal courts and victims' rights?
It's slowed things down immensely. There was a period of time where nothing was happening. Understandably, these are extraordinary circumstances and everybody's doing their best. But the reality is, for victims since COVID, things have been at a standstill for the most part. Cases are not resolving, and cases are not going to trial.
What does this mean for the
So,
victims? Because the voters wanted to support the victims in April, and that was so abundantly clear in a way that few ballot amendments or measures rarely are anywhere. So what does this mean for the victims?
I mean, it means that they're still waiting. And I think that that reflects sort of the broader point related to Marcy's Law, is that there's the laws that are adopted, but then if they are not implemented, or if people don't pay attention to them, then things really don't change. So whether this has the transformative effect that both proponents and opponents hope anticipated it would, remains to be determined. We're not seeing dramatic changes thus far.
Rachel Sattler, I very much appreciate your time this morning, and thank you so much for your work.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Sattler, an attorney with the Crime Victims Rights Project and the coordinator of the Volunteer Lawyer Project Madison Office at Legal Action of Wisconsin. She's also the co-founder of a nonprofit called Dane County Multi-Agency Center. We've got the news coming up next. Our state capitol report does continue after that with a look at how adjusting legislation could help pharmacists better address the COVID-19 response. We have had a slew of good news about potential vaccinations on the horizon and soon. But what does this mean about distribution? And if you've been concerned about the institutional way we have dealt with the pandemic, does that cause some concern about the way we will roll out the vaccine? Would you even take a vaccine? Questions worth asking as we continue your state capitol report with the CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin here next to talk logistics and what to expect in the weeks and months ahead. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Over three consecutive Mondays this November, we woke up to news from three different drug companies reporting promising results from three separate COVID vaccines. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent, and this is your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. The Wall Street Journal reports that United Airlines has started shipping doses of Pfizer's vaccine into the company's Pleasant Prairie distribution site in Kenosha County. If you follow the money, economists at Goldman Sachs are betting that by May 2021, half of the U.S. will have been vaccinated. But which half? Which vaccine? And who can help make the rollout of a vaccination in Wisconsin as successful as, I don't know, say, Tommy Thompson smashing things on social media? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to the studio. Ideas at WPR.org if you'd like to email us. Our guest is Sarah Sorum. She's the Executive Vice President and CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning, Lee.
You have a plan for a vaccination rollout in Wisconsin. But before we get there, I would like to start with how our pharmacists across Wisconsin have played a role in testing for COVID-19. Give us some insight here in what role pharmacists have played in the last 8 months in us trying to get a handle on this pandemic, Sarah.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me this morning. This is an important topic. Pharmacists are highly trained healthcare providers located in communities across the state. And what we've seen during this pandemic from all healthcare providers is an all hands on deck approach. And pharmacists have been part of the testing solutions in counties across the state. We have pharmacists that are running drive-through testing clinics, testing people in sun and rain and the cold weather we've had, and really helping to have communities respond.
So as you continue to deal with this, you have sent a letter to the state legislature saying that you have a plan in place for the distribution of vaccines across the state of Wisconsin. Can you give us some idea of how this plan was developed and whether or not you've received any response so far from the state legislature, Sarah?
Sure. We've really been working in collaboration with a lot of partners and stakeholders, the Wisconsin Immunization Program as part of the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin has done an amazing job of engaging us and other stakeholders in discussing the rollout of the vaccines. And we should say vaccines, not just a singular vaccine, because there will likely be more than one. And pharmacists, again, with that all-hands-on-deck approach, because of their location in communities and because of their roles within health systems, play a critical role in responding and assisting with the distribution plan for the vaccines. And so we think that there's a few regulatory and legislative opportunities for pharmacists to be able to serve in that role more fully. For example, we have a great group of trained student pharmacists across the state. There's three schools of pharmacy in the state, and right now the law limits students to have completed 2 years of pharmacy school before they can help with immunization services. We think that student pharmacists are ready to do that right away after they receive some additional training at the beginning of their 4 years or 3 years of study. So that's one of the asks. We also have a group of pharmacy technicians, a huge group of pharmacy technicians that could help with that all hands on deck approach and can be trained to, under the delegation of a pharmacist, assist with a COVID vaccine administration program. So those are a couple of the asks that we've put forward for both the legislature and the governor. We think this is a really important time for all parties to work together to support the healthcare providers at the front lines.
And there's some concern about where everybody fits in line or in a queue to get this vaccine. And for some, they're insured by their employer. For others, they have Medicaid. For some, they are uninsured completely. How are pharmacists treated differently than other healthcare providers when it comes to insurance and Medicaid, Sarah?
Yeah, so there will need to be a phased approach for the distribution of the vaccine. There won't be enough of the vaccines for everybody to receive it on day one. So there's been a lot of great conversations that have happened at the state level in particular related to how the vaccine that's supplied will roll out and over what period of time. And so, for example, the first individuals that will be vaccinated will be healthcare providers at the front lines. We need these individuals to be continuing to be able to serve at the front lines and respond to these surges that we've been having within hospitals. So that's an example of the first group that would receive the vaccine. There's also long-term care facilities that we know are at high risk for complications related to the vaccine. Patients that live in these facilities would be one of the other first groups to be immunized. So, yes, pharmacies traditionally have been treated as a building where product is dispensed, and we really believe, and over time pharmacists have shown, that they are healthcare providers that should be having healthcare provider parity related to reimbursement. So one of the other asks that we have is that we want to be sure that all doors to immunization services are open and that insurance policy needs to recognize pharmacists as providers of vaccine and have parity of reimbursement so that a patient can choose to go to their clinic or they can choose to go to their pharmacy to be immunized.
And that was one of the proposals that was put forth to the state legislature?
Yes, it is.
Have you received any response yet?
We're definitely in close communication with both the governor's office and the legislature, and we're optimistic about making sure that this all-hands-on-deck approach can be achieved.
Our guest is Sarah Sorum. She's the head of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. And pharmacists, would you like to see state lawmakers address COVID-19? And how? What plans would you like to see in place for the vaccine rollout? 1-800-642-1234 is a phone number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Do you have some concerns about where you stand in the queue and whether or not you would be considered essential employee or priority? And you know, I think, Sarah, that is what most folks are wondering, is where they fit in the grand scheme of things. Does the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin have any plan for who gets what and when, or is that still to be decided by, you mentioned healthcare workers and then the nursing homes, but then after that, who goes next?
Yeah, we are engaged in the conversations about that, but there's a group, the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee, a group of interdisciplinary stakeholders that are talking about the further fleshing out the plan that Department of Health Services has developed for how that vaccine will be distributed and prioritized. I wish that there was going to be enough for everybody on day one, but that just won't be the case. So it will need to be a rollout of priority groups to try and have the most public health impact as possible. And that'll be done with the ethical framework that SDMAC has put forward, and really transparent, and I applaud that group for their work on that prioritization. I think the most important thing I want people to know is that, you know, vaccines are really a very important science-based solution out of this pandemic, but there's also factors that we can do right now that impact stopping the spread. Wearing a mask, washing hands, physical distancing. It's so hard to do right now, particularly with the holidays. My family stayed home over Thanksgiving, and we did a Zoom pie baking and a Zoom Thanksgiving dinner. But what we're doing is helping those healthcare providers at the front lines be able to take care of us.
Yes.
And take care of one another.
And these vaccines present a potential light at the end of this pandemic tunnel, but we've got to get there from here. And that light might seem further away for healthcare providers and people on the front lines right now than it does for everybody else. And Sarah, some of the concerns seem to be deeply rooted in health disparities in Wisconsin and across the country. Have pharmacists seen some of these health disparities from their point of view, and have they seen those disparities impacted by this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think with everything in our day-to-day lives that the pandemic has exacerbated those issues and challenges. So healthcare disparities are certainly one of those things. We've seen the gaps related to other immunizations widen in populations that already had inequality related to vaccination receipt. And so pharmacists have, because of their location in the community, over 90% of people live within 5 miles of a pharmacy. So whether that's in your rural community or in an inner city, urban, underserved area, pharmacists are playing a role in getting health care and primary care to populations that need it. And so immunization services are one of those things. The testing is another. Other public health responses, like the distribution of naloxone for overdose, those are tobacco cessation, smoking cessation, all of these things that were important before the pandemic continue to be important now, and we need to position the care where people need it.
So the pharmacists of Wisconsin are ready to step up, front forward, and be right on the front lines of distributing this vaccine across the state of Wisconsin. They have a plan. They have sent a letter to the state legislature and are working now. Do we have a timeline, Sarah, of now that we know that the CDC director says in 2 weeks we'll have vaccines for nursing homes, Dr. Fauci says by the end of the month we'll have distribution in the states. What does your timeline look like?
Yeah, my understanding, and this changes on a day-to-day basis, but my understanding is the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, which is part of CDC, and they make all the vaccine recommendations for the country. They'll be meeting likely mid-December to review both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and the data that we're seeing, at least from press releases, is really promising. So, I think the early vaccine will be distributed potentially by the end of the year, but most of us will probably be receiving it well into 2021. And so right now it's important to follow all those preventative measures until that time.
We're discussing how the law can enable pharmacists to better address the COVID-19 response in Wisconsin. And our guest is the CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, Sarah Sorum. Take your calls next at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You know, on a typical morning here at the Ideas Network, I'd be in the control room right now, listening, turning things on and off, up or down, but mostly just listening. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I've heard your concerns, your calls, and questions about where you will find a place in line when it comes time for a COVID vaccine. And that time appears to be coming. And Wisconsin's pharmacists want to help, and they have a plan. Will it address your very real concerns? For those who have been critical of the government's response or lack of response to this pandemic, what would it take to overcome your skepticism? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Sarah Sorum. She's the Executive Vice President and CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. Let's go to your call now. Ray in Janesville, you're on the Ideas Network. Good morning.
Good morning to you. My question is, I understand this, the first responders are first to get the shot, but why isn't essential workers second in line? I drive truck. I've been out here 11 months and have kept myself safe so far, but all it's going to take is one time you know, for me to get infected. I can't understand why we're not second in line for these vaccination shots.
Ray, I appreciate your call, and I will just echo that sentiment for those that go into the grocery store. You'd want to make sure that everybody's as safe as possible who's going to be around you. It's part of the some of the stories that we're hearing, Sarah, and how would you address these concerns?
Yeah, Ray, thanks for your question, and thanks for all you're doing for responding to the pandemic. We have so many important essential workers that are really playing a critical role in keeping us going during this pandemic. So thanks for your work in that. You know, essential workers, whether they're driving truck or they're in grocery stores or shipping packages or, you know, in a meatpacking plant, are definitely a priority group for immunization services related to COVID. And so the group, that SDMAC, that State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee, is really looking at how they can get the vaccine to those essential worker groups as soon as possible.
Let's go to Jerry from Glendale. Jerry, you're on the Ideas Network with Sarah Sorum. Good morning.
Thank you so much. I'm 72 years old, and as soon as that vaccine is available, I'm going to be standing right there rolling up my sleeve to get my vaccination. It's well documented that there are large percentages of our population who have decided they're not going to be vaccinated. We need to have a certain number of people get vaccinated in order to have herd immunity. And the challenge is how to get people to see themselves as part of a larger community, not just interested in their own particular self-concern. So for the pharmacist, for Sarah, do you know of any particular widespread plan to increase community buy-in to this godsend that we have with the vaccine?
That vaccine confidence issue is so very critical. You just hit the nail right on the head that, you know, we need to have a comprehensive way to address concerns related to vaccine hesitancy and build up vaccine confidence. So really, I think that's what's happening now is it's a conversation between public health professionals and healthcare providers and community leaders to talk about people like you that are ready to be in line to roll up their sleeves. I'll be right there with you when it's my time to receive that vaccine. I'm excited to be vaccinated and get my family vaccinated. So how can we spread those messages and communicate that? So there's really some great conversations and plans that are being implemented to enhance that vaccine confidence. You know, it's happened fast. Science really stepped up and responded. And what the U.S. government is doing is making an investment in the manufacturing of the vaccine in parallel with the research studies so that the vaccine is available much faster than it would be if a company waited for all of those studies to come in and then started manufacturing. So because of that happening in parallel, you know, there's like, well, how can the vaccine be available so fast? Well, it's going through all of the same safety steps and trial steps that it would have gone through otherwise, but it's being manufactured in parallel and will be available much sooner as a result. So the financial risk that the company would have taken on is now being taken on by the U.S. government.
Our guest is Sarah Sorum, Executive Vice President and CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. And Sarah, some of the COVID-19 vaccines were reportedly working their way towards approval are going to require extreme cold storage. Much of Wisconsin made up of small and spread out communities within 5 miles from a pharmacy, but are they going to be within 5 miles from this cold storage, which may be required for some of these vaccines?
Yeah, so the vaccine that will likely be available first, the Pfizer vaccine, does require ultra-cold storage. And the other vaccines, though, do not, at least not what we're seeing currently. So it's really that very first vaccine that will likely be geared towards healthcare providers and potentially long-term care facilities. And so my understanding is the state is working on a hub-and-spoke model where there will be places that are able to accommodate that ultra-cold storage where the vaccine will go first, and then individual or providers that are administering the vaccine will get the vaccine from those ultra-cold storage hubs and use that spoke model to administer the vaccine. So there's really a lot of behind-the-scenes tactical work that's going on to make that cold chain storage work.
So with these three potential vaccines, I think all three of them are going to require two doses. How is that going to work out logistically? What kind of data management are pharmacists, doctors, and healthcare providers going to use to try to keep all that organized?
Yeah, Wisconsin residents are really blessed in that we have an amazing immunization registry, the Wisconsin Immunization Registry, that's used for, and pharmacists are required to report into that registry. All vaccines that are administered for COVID will have to be reported to that registry within 24 hours. So the registry will have a record of which vaccine you received and when you received it and when you'll be due for the follow-up vaccine. So that registry will really be an important tool that healthcare providers can use to make sure that you receive that second dose appropriately.
So I'd be interested in knowing if others have turned to their pharmacy during this pandemic. I have to honestly report, I do believe Walgreens checks in on my parents once a day, and for that I am grateful. But if you have some insight into this, if you're a pharmacist yourself and you're ready to roll out the vaccine, let us know at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Sorum, so from your perspective, what is vaccine confidence like among Wisconsinites? Are we going to be able to achieve some sort of safe immunity once the vaccine rollout is done?
Well, I'm really optimistic that there's amazing frontline public health professionals and healthcare providers addressing this pandemic from all sides, including vaccine distribution and vaccine confidence. And, you know, pharmacists are shown to be one of the top trusted healthcare professionals. And I'm so glad to hear that your parents are being checked in on regularly by a pharmacist. We have pharmacists across the state that are just really heroic during this pandemic time in taking care of the medication and public health needs of their patients. And so I think the future is bright as it relates to immunization services in Wisconsin.
If the people are willing to accept safe vaccines in Wisconsin. We had another caller who couldn't stay with us. Paula said she's hearing from coworkers that they're not going to get a vaccine. And the interesting part here, Sarah, is we talk about the importance of this distribution and you know, a safe and reliable distribution system could actually aid and abet a confidence level for this vaccine, right?
Absolutely. I think the distribution is, and making sure that the distribution is equitable, transparent, and also done well, executed well, really feed into our confidence around the vaccine.
Sarah Sorum, thank you so much for your time this morning. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be with you.
Sarah Sorum is the Executive Vice President and CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, who has sent a letter with a plan to the state legislature about how we can roll out in an organized and safe way the vaccines that are on the way. Just ahead, we're spotlighting Wisconsin's healthcare workers and nurses on the front lines of this pandemic. Our guests are here to share their latest challenges and take a look back at the last 8 months and a look ahead to the next year. With a light at the end of the tunnel, how far away does it feel for our healthcare workers, for our nurses? I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.